consider a few cases that are potent today. Because many of us believe in democracy and recognize that the security of democracy in the future depends critically on maintaining the belief in democracy, we are eager to quote, and quote, and quote, Winston Churchill's famous line, "Democracy is the worst form of government except all the other forms that have been tried." As stewards of democracy, we are often conflicted, eager to point to flaws that ought to be repaired, yet just as eager to reassure people that the flaws are not that bad, that democracy can police itself, so their faith in it is not misplaced. The same point can be made about science. Since the belief in the integrity of scientific procedures is almost as important as the actual integrity, there is always a tension between a whistleblower and the authorities, even when they know that they have mistakenly conferred scientific respectability on a fraudulently obtained result. Should they quietly reject the offending work and discreetly dismiss the perpetrator, or make a big stink? And certainly some of the intense public fascination with celebrity trials is to be explained by the fact that belief in the rule of law is considered a vital ingredient in our society. So, if famous people are seen to be above the law, this jeopardizes the general trust in the rule of law. Hence, we are interested not just in the trial, but in the public reactions to the trial and the reactions to those reactions, creating a spiraling inflation of media coverage. We who live in democracies have become somewhat obsessed with gauging public opinion on all matter of topics, and for good reason. In a democracy, it really matters what the people believe. If the public cannot be mobilized into extended periods of outrage by reports of corruption or the torturing of prisoners by our agents, for instance, our democratic checks and balances are in jeopardy. In his hopeful book, Development as Freedom, 1999, and elsewhere, see especially Sen, 2003, the Nobel laureate economist Amartya Sen makes the important point that you don't have to win an election to achieve your political aims. Even in shaky democracies, what the leaders believe about the beliefs that prevail in their countries influences what they take their realistic options to be. So belief maintenance is an important political goal in its own right. Even more important than political beliefs in the eyes of many are what we might call metaphysical beliefs. Nihilism, the belief in nothing, has been seen by many to be a deeply dangerous virus. For obvious reasons, when Friedrich Nietzsche hit upon his idea of the eternal recurrence, he thought he had proved that we relive our lives infinitely many times. His first inclination, according to some stories, was to kill himself without revealing the proof in order to spare others from this life-destroying belief. Belief in the belief that something matters is understandably strong and widespread. Belief in free will is another vigorously protected vision for the same reasons. And those whose investigations seem to others to jeopardize it are sometimes deliberately misrepresented in order to discredit what is seen as a dangerous trend. Dennett, 2003 C. The physicist Paul Davies, 2004, has recently defended the view that belief in free will is so important that it may be a fiction worth maintaining. It is interesting that he doesn't seem to think that his own discovery of the awful truth, what he takes to be the awful truth, incapacitates him morally, but believes that others, more fragile than he, will need to be protected from it. Being the unwitting or uncaring bearer of good news or bad news is one thing. Being the self-appointed champion of a meme is something quite different. Once people start committing themselves, in public or just in their hearts, to particular ideas, a strange dynamic process is brought into being in which the original commitment gets buried in pearly layers of defensive reaction and meta-reaction. Personal rules are a recursive mechanism. They continually take their own pulse, and if they feel it falter, that very fact will cause further faltering, the psychiatrist George Ainsley observes in his remarkable book, Breakdown of Will, 2001, page 88. He describes the dynamic of these processes in terms of competing strategic commitments that can contest for control in an organization or an individual. Once you start living by a set of explicit rules, the stakes are raised. When you lapse, what should you do? Punish yourself? Forgive yourself? Pretend you didn't notice? After a lapse, the long-range interest is in the awkward position of a country that has threatened to go to war in a particular circumstance that has then occurred. The country wants to avoid war without destroying the credibility of its threat, and may therefore look for ways to be seen as not having detected the circumstance. Your long-range interest will suffer if you catch yourself ignoring a lapse, but perhaps not if you can arrange to ignore it without catching yourself. This arrangement, too, must go undetected, which means that a successful process of ignoring must be among the many mental expedients that arise by trial and error, the ones you keep simply because they make you feel better without your realizing why, page 150. This idea that there are myths we live by, myths that must not be disturbed at any cost, is always in conflict with our ideal of truth-seeking and truth-telling, sometimes with lamentable results. For example, racism is at long last widely recognized as a great social evil. So many reflective people have come to endorse the second-order belief that belief in the equality of all people, regardless of their race, is to be vigorously fostered. How vigorously? Here, people of goodwill differ sharply. Some believe that belief in racial differences is so pernicious that even when it is true, it is to be squelched. This has led to some truly unfortunate excesses. For instance, there are clear clinical data about how people of different ethnicity are differently susceptible to disease or respond differently to various drugs. But such data are considered off-limits by some researchers and some funders of research. This has the perverse effect that strongly indicated avenues of research are deliberately avoided, much to the detriment of the health of the ethnic groups involved. Ainsley uncovers strategic belief maintenance in a wide variety of cherished human practices. Activities that are spoiled by counting them or counting on them have to be undertaken through indirection if they are to stay valuable. For instance, romance undertaken for sex or even to be loved is thought of as crass, as are some of the most lucrative professions if undertaken for money, or performance art if done for effect. Too great an awareness of the motivational contingencies for sex, affection, money, or applause spoils the effort, and not only because it undeceives the other people involved. Beliefs about the intrinsic worth of these activities are valued beyond whatever accuracy these beliefs might have, because they promote the needed indirection, in press. Though not at all restricted to religion, belief in belief is nowhere else a more fecund engine of elaboration. Ainsley surmises that it explains some of the otherwise baffling epistemic taboos found in religions. From priesthood to fortune-telling, contact with the intuitive seems to need some kind of divination. This is all the more true for approaches that cultivate a sense of empathy with a god. Several religions forbid the attempt to make their deity more tangible by drawing pictures of him, and Orthodox Judaism forbids even naming him. The experience of God's presence is supposed to come through some kind of invitation that he may or may not accept, not through invocation. 2001, page 192. What do people do when they discover that they no longer believe in God? Some of them don't do anything. They don't stop going to church, and they don't even tell their loved ones. They just quietly get on with their lives, living as morally or immorally as they did before. Others, such as Don Cupid, author of After God, The Future of Religion, feel the need to cast about for a religious creed that they can endorse with a straight face. They have a belief that belief in God is something to preserve, so when they find the traditional concepts of God frankly incredible, they don't give up. They seek a substitute. And the search, once again, need not be all that conscious and deliberate. Without ever being frankly aware that a cherished ideal is endangered in some way, people may be strongly moved by a nameless dread, the sinking sense of a loss of conviction. A threat intuited but not articulated that needs to be countered vigorously. This puts them in a state of mind that makes them particularly receptive to novel emphases that somehow seem right or fitting. Like sausage making and the crafting of legislation in a democracy, creed revision is a process that is upsetting to watch too closely, so it is no wonder that the fog of mystery descends so gracefully over it. Much has been written over the centuries about the historic processes by which polytheisms turned into monotheism. belief in gods being replaced by belief in God. What is less often stressed is how this belief in God joined forces with the belief in God to motivate the migration of the concept of God in the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, away from concrete anthropomorphism to ever more abstract and depersonalized concepts. What is remarkable about this can be illuminated by contrast with other conceptual shifts that have occurred during the same period. Fundamental concepts can certainly change over time. Our concept of matter has changed quite radically from the days of the ancient Greek atomists. Our scientific conceptions of time and space today, thanks to clocks and telescopes and Einstein and others, are different from theirs as well. Some historians and philosophers have argued that these shifts are not as gradual as they may at first appear, but rather are abrupt saltations, so drastic that the before and after concepts are incommensurable in some way. Are any of these conceptual revisions actually so revolutionary as to render communication across the ages impossible, as some have argued? The case is hard to make, since we can apparently chart the changes accurately and in detail, understanding them all as we go. In particular, there seems no reason to believe that our everyday conceptions of space and time would be even somewhat alien to Alexander the Great, say, or Aristophanes. We would have little difficulty conversing with either of them about today, tomorrow, and last year, or the thousands of years or paces between Athens and Baghdad. But if we tried to converse with the ancients about God, we would find a much larger chasm separating us. I can think of no other concept that has undergone so dramatic a deformation. It is as if their concept of milk had turned into our concept of health, or as if their concept of fire had turned into our concept of energy. You can't literally drink health or literally extinguish energy, and today, according to many but not all believers, you can't literally listen to God or literally sit beside Him. But these would be strange claims indeed to the original monotheists. The Old Testament Jehovah, or Yahweh, was quite definitely a superman, a he, not a she, who could take sides in battles and be both jealous and wrathful. The original New Testament Lord is more forgiving and loving, but still a father, not a mother or a genderless force, and active in the world, needless to say, through His miracle-performing Son. The genderless person without a body who nevertheless answers prayers in real time, Stark's conscious supernatural being, is still far too anthropomorphic for some, who prefer to speak of a higher power, Stark's essence, whose characteristics are beyond comprehension. Aside from the fact that they are, in some incomprehensible way, good, not evil. Does the higher power have creative intelligence? In what way? Does it, not he or she, care about us? About anything? The fog of mystery has descended conveniently over all the anthropomorphic features that have not been abandoned outright. And a further adaptation has been grafted on. It is impolite to ask about these matters. If you persist, you are likely to get a response along these lines. God can see you when you're doing something evil in the dark, but He does not have eyelids and never blinks, you silly, rude person. And of course He can read your mind even when you are careful not to talk to yourself. But still He prefers you to pray to Him in words, and don't ask me how or why. These are mysteries we finite mortals will never understand. People of all faiths have been taught that any such questioning is somehow insulting or demeaning to their faith and must be an attempt to ridicule their views. What a fine protective screen this virus provides, permitting it to shed the antibodies of skepticism effortlessly. But it doesn't always work, and when the skepticism becomes more threatening, stronger measures can be invoked. One of the most effective is also one of the most transparent— the old diabolical lie. The term comes from de Rougemont, 1944, who speaks of the putative proclivity of the father of lies for appearing as his own opposite. It is almost literally a trick with mirrors, and like many good magic tricks, it's so simple that it's hard to believe it could ever work. Novice magicians often have to steel themselves to perform tricks the first time in public. It just doesn't seem possible that audiences will fall for these, but they do. If I were designing a phony religion, I'd surely include a version of this little gem, but I'd have a hard time saying it with a straight face. If anybody ever raises questions or objections about our religion that you cannot answer, that person is almost certainly Satan. In fact, the more reasonable the person is, the more eager to engage you in open-minded and congenial discussion, the more sure you can be that you're talking to Satan in disguise. Turn away. Do not listen. It's a trap. What is particularly cute about this trick is that it is a perfect wild card, so lacking in content that any sect or creed or conspiracy can use it effectively. Communist cells can be warned that any criticism they encounter is almost sure to be the work of FBI infiltrators in disguise. And radical feminist discussion groups can squelch any unanswerable criticism by declaring it to be phallocentric propaganda being unwittingly spread by a brainwashed dupe of the evil patriarchy and so forth. This all-purpose loyalty enforcer is paranoia in a pill, sure to keep the critics muted if not silent. Did anyone invent this brilliant adaptation, or is it a wild meme that domesticated itself by attaching itself to whatever memes were competing for hosts in its neighborhood? Nobody knows, but now it is available for anybody to use. Although if this book has any success, its virulence should diminish as people begin to recognize it for what it is. A milder and more constructive response to relentless skepticism is the vigorous academic industry of theological discussion and research, very respectfully inquiring into the possible interpretations of the various creeds. This earnest intellectual exercise scratches the skeptical itch of those few people who are uncomfortable with the creeds they were taught as children, and is ignored by everybody else. Most people don't feel the need to examine the details of the religious propositions they profess. Mystery is declared to surround the various conceptions of God, but there is nothing mysterious about the process of transformation, which is clear for all to see and has been described and often decried by generations of would-be stewards of this important idea. Why don't the stewards just coin new terms for the revised conceptions and let go of the traditional terms along with the discarded conceptions? After all, we don't persist in the outmoded medical terminology of humors and apoplexy, or insist on finding something in contemporary physics or chemistry to identify as phlogiston. Nobody has proposed that we have discovered the identity of élan vital, the secret ingredient that distinguishes living things from mere matter. It's DNA. The vitalists just didn't have the right conception of it, but they knew there had to be something. Why do people insist on calling the higher power they believe in God? The answer is clear. The believers in the belief in God have appreciated that the continuity of professing requires continuity of nomenclature, that brand loyalty is a feature so valuable that it would be foolish to tamper with it. So whatever other reforms you may want to institute, don't try to replace the word God, Jehovah, Theos, Deus, the Almighty, our Lord, Allah, when you tinker with your religion. In the beginning was the Word. I have to say that it has worked pretty well after a fashion. For 1,000 years, roughly, we've entertained a throng of variously de-anthropomorphized, intellectualized concepts of God, all more or less peacefully coexisting in the minds of believers. Since everybody calls his or her version God, there is something we can all agree about. We all believe in God. We're not atheists. But of course it doesn't work that well. If Lucy believes that rock Hudson is to die for, and Desi believes that rock music is to die for, they really don't agree on anything, do they? The problem is not new. Back in the 18th century, Hume had already decided that our idea of a deity had shifted so much that the gods of antiquity simply didn't count, being too anthropomorphic. To anyone who considers justly of the matter, it will appear that the gods of all polytheists are not better than the elves and fairies of our ancestors, and merit as little any pious worship or veneration. These pretended religionists are really a kind of superstitious atheists and acknowledge no being that corresponds to our idea of a deity. No first principle of mind or thought, no supreme government and administration, no divine contrivance or intention in the fabric of the world. 1777, page 33. More recently, and chiding in the opposite direction, Stark and Fink, 2000, expressed dismay at the atheistic views of John Shelby Spong, the Episcopal bishop in Newark, whose God is not anthropomorphic enough. In his 1998 book, Why Christianity Must Change or Die, Spong dismisses the divinity of Jesus, declares the crucifixion barbaric, and opines that the God of most traditional Christians is an ogre. Another eminent Episcopal cleric once confided to me that when he found out what some Mormons believed when they said they believed in God, he rather wished they didn't believe in God. Why won't he say this from the pulpit? Because he doesn't want to let down the side. After all, there are lots of evil, godless people out there, and it would never do to upset the fragile fiction that we are not atheists, heaven forbid. 2. God as intentional object. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Psalms chapter 14, verse 1. Also, chapter 53, verse 1. Belief in God makes people reluctant to acknowledge the obvious, that much of the traditional lore about God is no more worthy of belief than the lore about Santa Claus or Wonder Woman. Curiously, it's all right to laugh about it. Consider all the cartoons depicting God as a stern, bearded fellow sitting on a cloud with a pile of lightning bolts at his side, to say nothing of all the jokes, bawdy and clean, about various folks arriving in heaven and having one misadventure or another. This treasury of humor provokes hearty chuckles from all but the most stuffy Puritans. But few are comfortable acknowledging just how far we've come from the God of Genesis chapter 2, verse 21, who literally plucks a rib from Adam and closes up the flesh, with his fingers, one imagines, before sculpting Eve on the spot. In A Devil's Chaplain, Richard Dawkins, 2003a, offers some sound advice, but knows in advance it will not be heeded, because people can see the punchline coming. Modern theists might acknowledge that when it comes to Baal and the golden calf, Thor and Wotan, Poseidon and Apollo, Mithras and Amun-Ra, they are actually atheists. We are all atheists about most of the gods that humanity has ever believed in. Some of us just go one god further. Page 150. The trouble is that since this advice won't be heeded, discussions of the existence of God tend to take place in a pious fog of indeterminate boundaries. If theists would be so kind as to make a short list of all the concepts of God they renounce as balderdash before proceeding further, we atheists would know just which topics were still on the table. But out of a mixture of caution, loyalty, and unwillingness to offend anyone on their side, theists typically decline to do this. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, I guess. This double standard is enabled, if not actually licensed, by a logical confusion that continues to defy resolution by philosophers who have worked on it. The problem of intentional objects. In a phrase which will prove unsatisfactory, as we will soon see, intentional objects are the things somebody can think about. Do I believe in witches? It all depends what you mean. If you mean evil-hearted spell-casting women who fly around supernaturally on broomsticks and wear black-pointed hats, the answer is obvious, no, I no more believe in witches than I believe in the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy. If you mean people, both men and women who practice Wicca, a popular New Age cult these days, the answer is equally obvious, yes, I believe in witches. They are no more supernatural than Girl Scouts or Rotarians. Do I believe these witches cast spells? Yes and no. They sincerely utter imprecations of various sorts, expecting to alter the world in various supernatural ways, but they are mistaken in thinking they succeed, though they may alter their own attitudes and behavior thereby. If I give you the evil eye, you may become seriously unnerved to the point of serious illness. But if so, that is because you are credulous, not because I have magical powers. So it all depends what you mean, and does it ever. About 40 years ago in England, I saw a BBC News program in which nursery school children were interviewed about Queen Elizabeth II. What did they know about her? The answers were charming. The Queen wore her crown while she hoovered Buckingham Palace, sat on the throne when she watched telly, and, in general, behaved like a cross between Mum and the Queen of Hearts. This Queen Elizabeth II, the intentional object brought into existence as an abstraction by the consensus convictions of these children, was much more interesting and entertaining than the real woman, and a more potent political force. Are there then two distinct entities, the real woman and the imagined queen, and if so, are there not millions or billions of distinct entities, the Queen Elizabeth II believed in by teenagers in Scotland and the Queen Elizabeth II believed in by the staff at Windsor Castle, and my Queen Elizabeth II, and so on. Philosophers have argued vigorously for the better part of a century about how to accommodate such intentional objects into their ontologies, their catalogs of the things that exist, with no emerging consensus. Another eminent Briton is Sherlock Holmes, who is often thought about even though he never existed at all. In one sense or another, there are both truths and falsehoods about such mere intentional objects. It is true that Sherlock Holmes, the intentional object created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, lived on Baker Street and smoked, and false that he had a bright green nose. It is true that Pegasus had wings in addition to four ordinary horse legs, and false that President Truman once owned him and rode him to the White House from Missouri. But, of course, neither Sherlock Holmes nor Pegasus is or ever was real. Some people may be under the mistaken impression that Sherlock Holmes actually existed, and that Conan Doyle stories aren't fiction. These people believe in Sherlock Holmes in the strong sense, let us say. Others, known as Sherlockians, devote their spare time to becoming Sherlock Holmes scholars, and can entertain one another with their encyclopedic knowledge of the Conan Doyle canon, without ever making the mistake of confusing fact with fiction. The most famous society of these scholars is the Baker Street Irregulars, named after the gang of street urchins that Holmes enlisted for various purposes over the years. Members of these societies, for there are many Sherlockian societies around the world, delight in knowing which train Holmes took from Paddington on May 12th, but know full well that there simply is no fact to be learned about whether he faced forward or backward in the train, since Conan Doyle didn't specify it or anything that would imply it. They know that Holmes is a fictional character, but nevertheless they devote large parts of their lives to studying him, and are eager to explain why their love of Holmes is better justified than some other fan's love of Perry Mason or Batman. They believe in Sherlock Holmes in the weak sense, let us say. They behave very much like the amateur scholars who devote their spare time to trying to figure out who Jack the Ripper was. And an observer who didn't know that the Holmes stories are fiction, whereas Jack the Ripper was a real murderer, might naturally suppose that the Baker Street Irregulars were investigating a historical person. It is quite possible for a mere intentional object like Sherlock Holmes to obsess people even when they know full well that it isn't real. So it is not surprising that such a thing, if it's right in the end to call it a kind of thing at all, can dominate people's lives when they believe in it in the strong sense, such as the people who spend fortunes hunting for the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot. And whenever a real person, such as Queen Elizabeth II, dominates people's lives, this domination is usually accomplished indirectly, by setting up a manifold of beliefs, giving people an intentional object that is featured in their thinking and the decisions they make. I can't hate my rival or love my neighbor without having a pretty clear and largely accurate set of beliefs that serve to pick this person out of the crowd so I can recognize, track, and interact effectively with him or her. In most circumstances, the things we believe in are perfectly real, and the things that are real we believe in. So we can usually ignore the logical distinction between an intentional object, the object of belief, and the thing in the world that inspired, caused, grounds, anchors the belief. Not always. The morning star turns out to be none other than the evening star. They are not stars. They are one and the same thing, namely the planet Venus. One planet, two intentional objects? Usually the things that matter to us make themselves securely known to us in a variety of ways that permit us to track them through their trajectories. But other scenarios do occur. I might sneak around thwarting your projects, or alternatively giving you good luck, dominating your life one way or another without your ever suspecting that I existed as a person, or a thing, or even a force in your life, but this is an unlikely possibility. In the main, things that make a difference in a person's life figure in it as intentional objects one way or another, however misidentified or misconstrued. When misconstruals occur, problems arise about how to describe the situation. Suppose you've been surreptitiously doing me good deeds for months. If I thank my lucky stars when it is really you I should be thanking, it would misrepresent the situation to say that I believe in you and am grateful to you. Maybe I am a fool to say in my heart that it is only my lucky stars that I should thank. Saying, in other words, that there is nobody to thank, but that is what I believe. There is no intentional object in this case to be identified as you. Suppose instead that I was convinced that I did have a secret helper, but that it wasn't you. It was Cameron Diaz. As I penned my thank you notes to her and thought lovingly about her and marveled at her generosity to me, it would surely be misleading to say that you were the object of my gratitude, even though you were in fact the one who did the deeds that I am so grateful for. And then suppose I gradually began to suspect that I had been ignorant and mistaken, and eventually came to the correct realization that you were indeed the proper recipient of my gratitude. Wouldn't it be strange for me to put it this way? Now I understand. You are Cameron Diaz. It would indeed be strange. It would be false. Unless something else had happened in the interim. Suppose my acquaintances had become so used to my singing the praises of Cameron Diaz and her bountiful works that the term had come, to them and to me, to stand for whoever it was who was responsible for my joy. In that case, those syllables would no longer have their original use or meaning. The syllables Cameron Diaz, purportedly a proper name of a real individual, would have been turned, gradually and imperceptibly, into a sort of wild card referring expression, the name of whoever or whatever is responsible for whatever it is I am grateful for. But then if the term were truly open-ended in this way, when I thank my lucky stars, I am thanking exactly the same thing as when I thank Cameron Diaz. And you do turn out to be my Cameron Diaz. The morning star turns out to be the evening star. How to turn an atheist into a theist by just fooling around with the words, if God were just the name of whatever it is that produced all creatures great and small, then God might turn out to be the process of evolution by natural selection. This ambiguity has been exploited ever since the psalmist sang about the fool. The fool doesn't know what he's talking about when he says in his heart there is no God. So he's ignorant in the same way as somebody who thinks that Shakespeare didn't actually write Hamlet. Somebody did. If Shakespeare is by definition the author of Hamlet, then perhaps Marlowe was Shakespeare, etc. When people write books about the history of God, Armstrong, 1993, Stark, 2001, Debray, 2004 are recent examples, they are actually writing about the history of the concept of God. Of course, tracing the fashions and controversies about God as intentional object through the centuries. Such a historical survey can be neutral in two regards. It can be neutral about which concept of God is correct. Did Shakespeare write Hamlet or did Marlowe write Hamlet? And it can be neutral about whether the whole enterprise concerns fact or fiction. Are we the Baker Street Irregulars, or are we trying to identify a real murderer? Rodney Stark opens One True God, Historical Consequences of Monotheism, with a passage that brandishes this ambiguity. All of the great monotheisms propose that their God works through history, and I plan to show that, at least sociologically, they are quite right, that a great deal of history, triumphs as well as disasters, has been made on behalf of One True God. What could be more obvious? 2001, page 1. His title suggests that he is not neutral, one true God. But the entire book is written sociologically, which means that it is not about God, it is about the intentional objects that do all the political and psychological lifting. The God of the Catholics, the God of the Jews, the God of teenagers living in Scotland, perhaps. It is indeed obvious that God, the intentional object, has played a potent role. But that says nothing about whether God exists, and it is disingenuous of Stark to hide behind the ambiguity. The history of disagreement has not all been good, clean fun, after all, like the Baker Street Irregulars versus the Perry Mason fan club. People have died for their theories. Stark may be neutral, but the comedian Rich Jenny isn't. As he sees it, religious war is pathetic. You're basically killing each other to see who's got the better imaginary friend. What is Stark's opinion about that, and what is yours? Might it be all right, even obligatory, to fight for a concept, whether or not the concept refers to anything real? After all, one might add, hasn't the strife brought us a bounty of great art and literature in the arms race of competitive glorification? I find that some people who consider themselves believers actually just believe in the concept of God. I myself believe that the concept exists. As Stark says, what could be more obvious? These people believe, moreover, that the concept is worth fighting over. Notice that they don't believe in belief in God. They are far too sophisticated for that. They are like the Baker Street Irregulars who don't believe in belief in Sherlock Holmes, but just in studying and extolling the lore. They do think that their concept of God is so much better than other concepts of God that they should devote themselves to spreading the word. But they don't believe in God in the strong sense. By definition, one would think theists believe in God. Atheism is the negation of theism, after all. But there is little hope of conducting an effective investigation into the question of whether God exists when there are self-described theists who think that providing a satisfactory theistic ethics requires giving up the idea that God is some kind of supernatural entity. Ellis, 2004. If God is not some kind of supernatural entity, then who knows whether you or I believe in him, it? Beliefs in Sherlock Holmes, Pegasus, witches on broomsticks, these are the easy cases, and they can be quite readily sorted out with a little attention to detail. When it comes to God, on the other hand, there is no straightforward way of cutting through the fog of misunderstanding to arrive at a consensus about the topic under consideration. And there are interesting reasons why people resist having a specific definition of God foisted on them, even for the sake of argument. The mists of incomprehension and failure of communication are not just annoying impediments to rigorous refutation. They are themselves design features of religions worth looking at closely on their own. 3. The division of doxastic labor. Fake it until you make it. Alcoholics Anonymous. So we have the strange phenomenon, as Kant assures us, of a mind believing with all its strength in the real presence of a set of things of no one of which it can form any notion whatsoever. William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Language gives us many gifts, including the capacity to memorize, transmit, cherish, and in general protect formulas that we don't understand. Here is a sentence I firmly believe to be true. 1. Her insan dogar yasser ve ulur. I haven't the foggiest idea what one means, but I know it's true because I asked a trusted Turkish colleague to provide me with a true sentence for just this purpose. I would bet a large amount of money on the truth of this sentence. That's how sure I am that it's true. But as I say, I don't know whether one is about trees, or people, or history, or chemistry, or God. There is nothing metaphysically peculiar, or difficult, or unseemly, or embarrassing about my state of mind. I just don't know what proposition this sentence expresses, because I'm not expert in Turkish. In Chapter 7, I noted the methodological problems confronting anthropologists intent on understanding other cultures, and suggested that part of the problem is that individual informants may not view themselves as experts on the doctrines they are asked to elucidate. The problems that arise for such half-understood ideas are exacerbated in the case of religious doctrines, but are as often encountered in science as in religion. Here, one might say, is the ultimate division of labor, the division of doxastic labor made possible by language. We lay people do the believing, we sign on to the doxology, and defer the understanding of those dogmas to the experts. Consider the ultimate talismanic formula of science. 2. E equals MC squared. Do you believe that E equals MC squared? I do. We all know that this is Einstein's great equation, and the heart, somehow, of his theory of relativity. And many of us know what the E and M and C stand for, and could even work out the basic algebraic relationships and detect obvious errors in interpreting it. But only a tiny fraction of those who know that E equals MC squared is a fundamental truth of physics actually understand it in any substantive way. Fortunately, the rest of us don't have to. We have expert physicists around to whom we have gratefully delegated responsibility for understanding the formula. What we are doing in these instances is not really believing the proposition. For that, you'd have to understand the proposition. What we are doing is believing that whatever proposition is expressed by the formula E equals MC squared is true. The difference for me between 1 and 2 is that I know quite a lot, but not enough, about what 2 is about. In the infinite space of all possible propositions, I can narrow down its meaning to a rather tight cluster of nearly identical variants. A physicist could probably trip me up by getting me to endorse an almost right paraphrase that would reveal my ignorance. That's what really tough multiple-choice exams can do, separating the students who really understand the material from those who only sort of understand the material. With one, however, all I know is that it expresses one of the true propositions, cutting the infinite space of propositions in half, but still leaving infinitely many propositions indistinguishable by me as its best interpretation. I can guess that it is probably not about how the Red Sox beat the Yankees 4 straight to win the American League Championship in October 2004, but such whittling away doesn't take us far. I drew an example from science to show that this is not an embarrassing foible of religious belief alone. Even scientists rely every day on formulas that they know to be correct but are not themselves expert in interpreting. And they sometimes even foster the separation of understanding and memorization. A vivid instance can be found in Richard Feynman's classic introductory lectures on quantum electronics, QED, The Strange Theory of Light and Matter, 1985, in which he amusingly cajoles his audience to loosen their grip and not try to understand the method he is teaching. So now you know what I'm going to talk about. The next question is, will you understand what I'm going to tell you? No, you're not going to be able to understand it. Why, then, am I going to bother you with all this? Why are you going to sit here all this time when you won't be able to understand what I am going to say? It is my task to convince you not to turn away because you don't understand it. You see, my physics students don't understand it either. That is because I don't understand it. Nobody does. It's a problem that physicists have learned to deal with. They've learned to realize that whether they like a theory or they don't like a theory is not the essential question. Rather, it is whether or not the theory gives predictions that agree with experiment. It is not a question of whether a theory is philosophically delightful or easy to understand or perfectly reasonable from the point of view of common sense. Please don't turn yourself off because you can't believe nature is so strange. Just hear me all out, and I hope you'll be as delighted as I am when we're through. Pages 9 and 10. He goes on to describe the methods of calculating probability amplitudes in terms that deliberately discourage understanding. You will have to brace yourselves for this, not because it is difficult to understand, but because it is absolutely ridiculous. All we do is draw little arrows on a piece of paper. That's all. Page 24. But defends this because the results the methods yield are so impressively accurate. To give you a feeling for the accuracy of these numbers, it comes out to something like this. If you were to measure the distance from Los Angeles to New York to this accuracy, it would be exact to the thickness of a human hair. That's how delicately quantum electrodynamics has, in the past 50 years, been checked, both theoretically and experimentally. Page 7. And that is the most important difference between the division of labor in religion and science. In spite of Feynman's uncharacteristically hyper-modest denial, the experts do understand the methods they use, not everything about them, but enough to explain to one another and to themselves why the amazingly accurate results come out of them. It is only because I am confident that the experts really do understand the formulas that I can honestly and unabashedly cede the responsibility of pinning down the propositions, and hence understanding them, to them. In religion, however, the experts are not exaggerating for effect when they say they don't understand what they are talking about. The fundamental incomprehensibility of God is insisted upon as a central tenet of faith, and the propositions in question are themselves declared to be systematically elusive to everybody. Although we can go along with the experts when they advise us which sentences to say we believe, they also insist that they themselves cannot use their expertise to prove, even to one another, that they know what they are talking about. These matters are mysterious to everybody, experts and lay people alike. Why does anybody go along with this? The answer is obvious. Belief in belief. Many people believe in God. Many people believe in belief in God. What's the difference? People who believe in God are sure that God exists, and they are glad, because they hold God to be the most wonderful of all things. People who moreover believe in belief in God are sure that belief in God exists, and who could doubt that, and they think that this is a good state of affairs, something to be strongly encouraged and fostered wherever possible. If only belief in God were more widespread. One ought to believe in God. One ought to strive to believe in God. One should be uneasy, apologetic, unfulfilled. One should even feel guilty if one finds that one just doesn't believe in God. It's a failing, but it happens. It is entirely possible to be an atheist and believe in belief in God. Such a person doesn't believe in God, but nevertheless thinks that believing in God would be a wonderful state of mind to be in, if only that could be arranged. People who believe in belief in God try to get others to believe in God, and whenever they find their own belief in God flagging, do whatever they can to restore it. It is rare but possible for people to believe in something while regretting their belief in it. They don't believe in their own belief. If I found that I believed in poltergeists or the Loch Ness Monster, I'd be, well, embarrassed. I'd think of this as one of those dirty little secrets about me that I wished were not so, and I'd be glad that nobody else knew. I might take steps to cure myself of this awkward bulge in my otherwise impeccably hard-headed and rational ontology. People sometimes suddenly awake to the fact that they are racists or sexists or have lost their love of democracy. None of us want to discover these things about ourselves. We all have ideals by which we measure the beliefs we discover in ourselves, and belief in God has been one of the most salient ideals for a long time for many people. In general, if you believe some proposition, you also believe that anybody who disbelieves it is mistaken. And by and large, it's too bad when people are mistaken or ill-informed or ignorant. In general, the world would be a better place if people shared more truths and believed fewer falsehoods. That's why we have education and public information campaigns and newspapers and so forth. There are exceptions. Strategic secrets, for instance, cases where I believe something and am grateful that nobody else shares my belief. Some religious beliefs may consist in proprietary secrets, but the general pattern is for people not just to share, but to try to persuade others, especially their own children, of their religious beliefs. 4. The lowest common denominator? God is so great that the greatness precludes existence. Raimundo Panikkar, The Silence of God. It is the final proof of God's omnipotence that he needs not exist in order to save us. Sermon by the hyper-liberal Reverend Mackerel, hero of The Mackerel Plaza by Peter DeVries. The church militant and the church triumphant has become the church social and the church bizarre. Robert Benson, Personal Communication, 1960. Many people believe in God. Many more people believe in belief in God. We can be quite sure that, since just about everybody who believes in God also believes in belief in God, there are actually more people in the world who believe in belief in God than those who believe in God. The world's literature, including uncounted sermons and homilies, teems with tales of people racked with doubt and hoping to recover their belief in God. We've just seen that our concept of belief allows that there is a clear empirical difference between these two states of mind. But here is a perplexing question. Of all the people who believe in belief in God, what percentage, roughly, also actually believe in God? Investigating this empirical question turns out to be extremely difficult. Why? At first, it looks as if we could simply give people a questionnaire with a multiple-choice question on it. I believe in God. Yes. No. I don't know. Or should the question be, God exists? Yes. No. I don't know. Would it make any difference how we framed the questions? I have begun conducting research on just such questions, and the results are tantalizing, but not yet sufficiently confirmed to publish. The main problem with such a simple approach is obvious. Given the way religious concepts and practices have been designed, the very behaviors that would be clear evidence of belief in God are also behaviors that would be clear evidence of only belief in God. If those who have doubts have been enjoined by their church to declare their belief in spite of their doubts, to say the words with as much conviction as they can muster again and again, in hopes of kindling conviction, to join hands and recite the creed, to pray several times a day in public, to do all the things that a believer does, then they will check the yes box with alacrity. Even though they really don't believe in God, they fervently believe in belief in God. This fact makes it hard to tell who, if anybody, actually believes in God in addition to believing in belief in God. Thanks to the division of labor, it is actually worse than that, as you may already have fathomed. You may find that when you look in your heart, you simply do not know whether you yourself believe in God. Which God are we talking about? Unless you are an expert and sure that you understand the formulas that officially express the propositions of your creed, your state of mind must be somewhere in the middle ground between my state of mind with regard to, 1, the sentence in Turkish, and my state of mind with regard to, 2, Einstein's formula. You're not as clueless as I am regarding, 1. You have studied and probably even memorized the official formulas, and you believe that these formulas are true, whatever they mean. But you have to admit that you are no authority on what they mean. Many Americans find themselves in this position, as Alan Wolfe notes in The Transformation of American Religion, How We Actually Live Our Faith, his recent survey of developments in American religion. These are people who believe, often passionately, in God, even if they cannot tell others all that much about the God in which they believe. 2003, page 72. If you fall in this category, you must admit, contrary to the way Wolfe puts it, that although you may well be one of those who believe in belief in God, you aren't really in a good position to judge whether you actually believe, passionately or otherwise, in the God of your particular creed or in some other God. And you have almost certainly never taken a tough multiple-choice test to see if you can reliably distinguish the expert's conception of God from the subtle impostors that are almost right. Alternatively, you can set yourself up as your own authority. I know what I mean when I utter the creed, and that's good enough for me. And that's good enough these days for a surprising number of organized religions, too. Their leaders have come to realize that the robustness of the institution of religion doesn't depend on uniformity of belief at all. It depends on the uniformity of professing. This has long been a feature of some strains of Judaism. Fake it and never mind if you make it, as my student Uriel Mashulam once vividly put it to me. Recognizing that the very idea of commanding someone to believe something is incoherent on its face, an invitation to insincerity or self-deception. Many Jewish congregations reject the demand for orthodoxy, right belief, and settle for orthopraxy, right behavior. Instead of creating secret pockets of festering guilty skepticism, they make a virtue of candid doubt, respectfully expressed. As long as the formulas get transmitted down through the ages, the memes will survive and flourish. Much the same attitude has recently been adopted by many evangelical Christian denominations, especially the booming new phenomenon of megachurches, which, as Wolf describes in some detail, go out of their way to give their members plenty of elbow room for personal interpretations of the words they claim to be holy. Wolf distinguishes sharply between evangelicalism and fundamentalism, which tends to be more preoccupied with matters of theological substance. His conclusion is intended to be reassuring. But those who fear the consequences for the United States of a return to strong religious belief should not be fooled by evangelicalism's rapid growth. On the contrary, evangelicalism's popularity is due as much to its populistic and democratic urges, its determination to find out exactly what believers want, and to offer it to them, as it is to Certainties of the Faith, 2003, page 36. Wolf shows that Stark and Fink's frank marketing approach is not at all foreign to religious leaders themselves. He notes without irony some of the concessions they are willing to make to contemporary secular culture, concessions that go far beyond websites and multi-million-dollar television programs or the introduction of electric guitars, drums, and PowerPoint in their services. For instance, the term sanctuary is shunned by one church because of its strong religious connotations, page 28, and more attention is paid to providing plenty of free parking and babysitting than to the proper interpretation of passages of Scripture. Wolf has conducted many probing interviews with his informants, and they reveal that revision of tradition is often hard to distinguish from outright rejection. A derisive term has been coined by these mimetic engineers to describe the image they are trying hard to shed, churchianity, page 50. Indeed, Lars and Anne, like many evangelicals throughout the country, say that faith is so important to them that religion, which they associate with discord and agreement and therefore, if often in an unexpected way, with doctrine, cannot be allowed to interfere with its exercise, page 73. There is no denying the results of this marketing expertise. Pastor Chuck Smith's Calvary Chapel has over 600 churches, some of them with 10,000 worshipers a week, Wolf 2003, page 75. Dr. Creflo Dollar's World Changers Church has 25,000 members, but only 30% of them were regular tithers, Sane 2004, page 48. According to Wolf, all of America's religions face the same imperative, personalize or die. Each does so in different ways, page 35. He may be right, but his argument for this sweeping conclusion is sketchy and anecdotal. And though there can be no doubt that the phenomena he describes exist, the question of whether they will be permanent features of religion from now on or a passing fad is a question that cries out for a testable theory, not just a set of observations, however sensitive. Whatever its staying power and the reasons for it, the example of such laissez-faire, non-creedal religion contrasts vividly with the continuing doctrinal emphasis of the Roman Catholic Church. 5. Beliefs designed to be professed. A mountain climber foolishly climbing alone slips off a precipice and finds himself dangling at the end of his safety rope, 1,000 feet above a ravine. Unable to climb the rope or swing to a safe resting spot, he calls out in despair, "Hello! Hello! Can anybody help me?" To his astonishment, the clouds part. A beautiful light pours through them, and a mighty voice replies, "Yes, my son, I can help you. Take your knife and cut the rope." The climber takes out his knife, and then he stops, and thinks, and thinks. Then he cries out, "Can anybody else help me?" According to the old maxim, actions speak louder than words, but this actually doesn't say what it means. Speech acts are actions, too, and a person who says, for instance, that infidels deserve death is performing an action with potentially deadly effects, which is about as loud as acting can get. What the maxim means on reflection is that actions other than speech acts are typically better evidence of what the actor really believes than any words the actor might say. It is easy enough to pay lip service, such a wonderful idiom. But when the concrete consequences of your actions depend on whether you believe something, whether you believe the gun is loaded, whether you believe the door is unlocked, whether you believe you are unobserved, lip service is a puny datum easily swamped by the nonverbal behavior that expresses, indeed betrays, your true beliefs. And here is an interesting fact. The transition from folk religion to organized religion is marked by a shift in beliefs from those with very clear, concrete consequences to those with systematically elusive consequences. Paying lip service is just about the only way you can act on them. If you really believe that the rain god won't provide rain unless you sacrifice an ox, you sacrifice an ox if you want it to rain. If you really believe that your tribe's god has made you invulnerable to arrows, you readily run headlong into a swarm of deadly arrows to get at your enemy. If you really believe that your god will save you, you cut the rope. If you really believe that your god is watching you and doesn't want you to masturbate, you don't masturbate. You wouldn't masturbate with your mother watching you. How on earth could you masturbate with God watching you? Do you really believe God is watching you? Perhaps not. But what could you do to show that you really believe that the wine in the chalice has been transformed into the blood of Christ? You could bet a large sum of money on it and then send the wine to the biology lab to see if there was hemoglobin in it and recover the genome of Jesus from the DNA in the bargain. Except that the creed has been cleverly shielded from just such concrete tests. It would be a sacrifice.